I'm explaining these patterns to you not because there is some major nuggets of information here. This is something that I've practiced over the last few years. So it's more like I'm trying to share with you what I've learned. So I do recognize a lot of expertise in this room. So please feel free to suggest anything that you've seen, something similar. The first thing is the unified abstract configuration pattern. That's a lot of words, but what it's trying to do is it's abstract because you can have either XML configuration files, properties configuration files, one file, 10 files, database, it really doesn't matter. If the client can access it through a single abstraction, like an interface. It's unified because, for example, if you go and download Tomcat has its own configuration file. As an application designer, as a web application designer, you end up with your own configuration files. So you can't put your configuration right in the middle of Tomcat's configuration file. So the idea here is that both the container and the components use the same configuration abstraction. That's why it's unified abstract configuration. And also, this is something, a competing pattern is obviously the inverse of control pattern. Probably some of you have already heard that. There are some parallels to both approaches. Both have its advantages and disadvantages. So again, we'll cover that later as we come down. The way I've organized this into the title is basically the title of the pattern. And the picture you're looking at is a structure. It's a static structure of the pattern. And the left-hand side is some of the characteristics that uniquely distinguish the pattern from anything else. Here, what it is essentially saying is you have an idea of an application every time you write some code. And the application has an interface called a configuration interface. And the application only interacts with the configuration interface. And you have varieties of implementations of the configuration. You start out with a simple properties file on day one, and you are up and running, and you're testing your client code. After a couple of weeks go by, you can migrate the properties file to an XML file, and the client doesn't have to change. And after a couple of days, you can provide your configuration in 10 files as opposed to one file, and you can go on and on, and you put it in there. But essentially, the client will still see a unified interface to the configuration. Here's an example of equivalence. For example, you have properties files and XML files. Essentially, the structure is the same in both cases. The format may be different. The abstract structure of idea is the same. And also, when you're dealing with XML, you can see the idea of an attribute and a child node is essentially, conceptually, they're the same. It is only a syntactical nuance there. So things like you can optimize some of these ideas and come up with a very unified abstraction of it. Here are some examples. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on the details. That note. So this basically gives you what I'm really talking about. So if you have a slightly high resolution monitor, and if you go, it'll so this gives you real-world examples with actual code and how it is used. And gives you a couple of references at the bottom to link you back into the server-side patterns again. So you can navigate through the examples based off the real one. Now here is another, when we talk about patterns, probably the first citizen of the patterns is obviously the factory pattern. There are so many things you can do with it. So you can metamorphosize itself into, you know, 10, 15 different patterns. What this is trying to say is, when you instantiate the objects, try to use an indirect mechanism to do it. And also, the fundamental problem this unified objects or factory pattern tries to solve is we end up writing factories for every class in our code. What this is trying to suggest is you can get away with a single factory even if you have any number of classes. You don't have to worry about writing individually, you know, 50 factories and 50 classes, and you don't have to split the wires. That's the idea behind it. And the same idea, and in addition to that, the moment you postpone object construction via a factory, you can take advantage of location services, single instance, multi-instance services. You can use delegates, filters, clustering, in-process components, lightweight containers. So it opens up the door for doing interception and applying some of the aspect-oriented principles into your regular coding. And all of this you can do without actually getting aspect compiler or anything like that. And here, what this frame says is that, again, a factory is represented as an interface. And you can have varieties of factories. For example, there's a basic factory and there's a remote factory. And you can have like a IOC factory or more complicated factories, more complicated strategies. But as far as the client is concerned, it's always saying, okay, here is a symbolic name for my object. Just give me an implementation for it. So you can alter the sophisticatedness of your factory strategies. Here's some examples, but again, you can click on these code examples to see what exactly the code behind these factories are. Once you have this, what I call a super factory, if necessary, in fact, you can have your own class factory instantiating your class you want and give it back to the client. So that model is still preserved in cases where it is necessary, but for a lot of the times, you don't have to use that model. So I call this a typed abstract factory idea because your class is being generated by a unique class factory that is completely a typed method call.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Do you have to use reflection to make this happen?
It will be beneficial. You can do a lot of interesting things with it if you use reflection. But that's why some of the interfaces on the right-hand side, these are, if you make use of the interfaces, then you don't have to use reflection. But if you don't have those interfaces, then you need to use reflection to find some interesting things. Here's an example, I call it typed abstract factory one, as opposed to a typed abstract factory. Here, the class itself acts as a factory for itself. So in cases where you don't need any other additional interaction, it can act as an abstract. And you can also use something like an abstract delegate, which is more like a functor, or more like an object, a function represented as an object. And again, here is back to our original reason behind the factory being an interface, because you can have a filter-based factories, you can have IOC-based factories, you can have remote factories for clustering and things like that. So the moment you manage your ideas as interfaces, it becomes so much easier to change the implementation. Okay, that kind of gives you a brief introduction of what factories are. And then we come into declarative relational data sets. This is where we are now into the data access model. Here, all data assumes and get retrieved as a relational data set. Obviously the row sets is equivalent are basically those are relational data sets that are, you can get them from a file, you can get them from database or CSS or anything. What this pattern adds to that part is let's make them declarative so that we simply specify the data and not programmatically program to get into CAPI. That's the idea of the relational data sets. So there's a data specification, connections are managed by adapters, transactions are managed by adapters, a collection of objects, it can represent either a collection of rows and columns in a typeless way, or it can represent a collection of objects coming back. Here is again a structural representation of the idea behind it. And again, it uses the abstract delegate pattern we talked about earlier. And what we have is the client looks at the data coming back as a I data collection that is equivalent to your row sets. And if necessary, those I data collection can give back to the client either a typeless I data row or an object itself back to the client. The implementation for this, the abstract data producers, you have the idea of a JDBC card, which knows about how to retrieve data from databases, very declaratively. And you have an Oracle stored procedure part, because Oracle, the way you call the stored procedures in Oracle are different than using a straightforward SQL from a JDBC. That's why it is specialized. And you have a file part, CSS part, so on and so forth. It's probably worthwhile taking an example of how do you take these horizontal parts. The reason I call them horizontal parts is because they can be used in more than one situation to retrieve your data. They're not special purpose parts. But here's an example of one of those parts used to retrieve some data from a database. So the first part, you specify the database name, and the transaction name is called get rows, and here's my database name, and you select star from the table, you put some arguments, and so essentially that is called a horizontal part because it doesn't know that my table has certain rows. All it knows is that here's a select statement that I want to execute. And here is how we do So here's variety of examples exploring the topic further. And then we move on to, once we have an idea that the data can be represented as relational data sets, if we can compose them into a hierarchical data structure, something similar to XML, so that a web page can directly use it. So we don't have to write any special code for it. So we simply composing the relational data sets. Again, the key point is that we are declaring the data and we are not really programming for it. Again, connections and transactions are automatically managed with container. And there's also a Java API for the abstraction. And here's a very similar idea behind it. The client explicitly deals with the data structure called IHDS, which is a hierarchical data set. And the HDS producer is just another part, just like you saw before. And that part, in turn, uses the relational data parts, which are, again, horizontal in nature, at the bottom. JDBC part, Oracle part, file part. Does anybody want to see an example of how the data is retrieved from a part? If you raise your hand, I'll show you the example. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next one. This is the Java API for retrieving the data from the hierarchical data set. You essentially have a concept of a collection of rows. Inside each row, you have a collection of columns and values. And a hierarchical data set has a n number of collections. Like a page has n tables and n list boxes. A hierarchical data set has a n number of named collections. Inside each collection, you have rows and columns. And all of the entire data is retrieved from the database in a single declarative data specification. One complaint about the idea of declarative, these either hierarchical data sets or relational data sets, one complaint I always get is, well, they don't have types. When I'm sitting on my JSP page, I have to use column names to retrieve my value and put it on the screen. For some people, it's okay, but some people are more IDE-centric and they want the IDE to prompt for this given object or all these fields. So that is the reason why we have a typed hierarchical data sets where you take a non-typed entities and you cast it to a predefined object. Using reflection, you bind the incoming XML data set to the object itself and you go from there. So there is a language binder that takes the hierarchical data set, which is on the right-hand side, and bind it to either a C-sharp class or a Java class or an action script, and then the client explicitly uses the data structure. So declaratively, you're essentially getting your data, declaratively you're binding your object, and you're utilizing it. So that is the entire pipeline of the process. Now, when we take this up, when we take this concept of relational data set, declarative, hierarchical data sets, declarative, when we move it to the slightly higher levels, when the programmers start using these facilities, what is their experience of the development process? Then it looks very similar to what I call transparent data pipelines. The reason for that is, so here is a hierarchical data set which is on the left-hand side. The data is being poured into the pipeline using various parts. All of them are pouring relational data into the channel, and the hierarchical data set is being given to the JSP page, which is at the bottom. But again, how do we specify those data adapters to pour that data into the pipeline? We simply have a config file. So from a developer's perspective, he's looking at a config file and the JSP page, and nothing else is in his view. That's why it's called a transparent data pipeline. Establishes a direct view of your data to the front-end development, but at the same time keeping the data using a true MVC paradigm separate from the other process. And here is very similar to the hierarchical data sets, just that the way you use it is slightly different. Now we are coming to the business logic side of things. Again, I'm really apologize because I'm running through these without giving any context to some of these things. I really apologize for that, but hopefully the website behind the scenes, if any of you are more interested in the idea behind it, you can go to the website and take a look at the examples and bother me as much as you want with questions, and I'm more than happy to develop. So the software parts are nothing new. A lot of developments have it. All I'm saying here is that it's a good pattern to follow, particularly in the horizontal, because these parts become very well tested in multiple. You can use the same part in 10 environments because it doesn't have any application-specific functionality in it. So they get well tested. So when you reuse them, you get all the benefits of it. That's why the horizontal parts are so useful. So the key concepts are one part for one job. Your functionality of the job is expressed as an object. It is declarative. Once we have these parts, and we can put them in pipelines and things like that, more advanced features. We have an abstract delegate, which the factory invokes it. And we have your part, which really does the actual work for you. And the part can turn around and use a configuration file to reconfigure itself when it is needed. The question people ask, okay, if it is a part, why are you bringing the abstract factory in the middle of it? The reason is the parts will evolve over time. Either so your backward compatibility becomes an issue if you continue to ship new software and if you don't have this abstraction. With this abstraction, you can call it part one, part one one, part one one two. So as you supply your new software, the older implementations can still be using part one, and then I would look at, so your code becomes slightly larger, but again, you're giving the end user a benefit that they don't have to worry about those, the new release will break something. So that's the key advantage of having a part instantiated through a factory as opposed to directly coding into your code. And also, not to mention, today you're getting the data from SQL statement. Somebody says, well, you can't do SQL here, you only use stored products. Okay, fine, change your part. So the client code doesn't have to worry about it. Now, parts really get their real power when you put them in what I call a pipelines, a part pipelines. This is similar to ANT, task. This is nothing crazy about it. But when you roll the transactions around it, and then you integrate that into your regular development process, it becomes a very powerful paradigm for rapid prototyping of your applications. So here, again, you have an abstract part, and even your workflow, which is essentially the pipeline you're talking about, and there is a loop part, there is an if part, or an asynchronous part. All of these are nothing but parts to the system. But when you put a part against a task, you can take the, without introducing any more new concepts, workflow can be implemented in your systems. I think it's worth looking at an example of this pipeline. If I can get my mouse to work. So here is so let us consider a web transaction called a append text. So there's a URL coming in, and there is something called append text, that is the name of the URL. There is a argument called report ID, and there's the append text. You take this text and append it to this particular ID interface. So here, obviously, the workflow part is that long named the pre-translate args multi-request executor. What that part is essentially, because it is a